the airstrike, and the backstory today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. U.S. troops in Syria found themselves under fire yesterday, and they responded.
Our forces have the inherent right to self-defense.
But there's also a backstory.
What we're hearing from both the Syrian government and from coalition officials is this was a clash that was likely sparked over a struggle for control of oil and gas fields in this part of Syria.
Plus the pain some Koreans feel about their divided peninsula.
Your families will live in North Korea, but you can't go there, you can't meet. You know, you almost like cry and how painful it is.
We meet one South Korean who set out to bridge that divide with music. That's ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to have you with us today. Here is a reminder that the United States is still very much involved in the conflict in Syria. Late yesterday, American military advisors in Syria came under attack. According to the U.S. Military Central Command, the perpetrators were not from ISIS, but were in fact forces loyal to Syria's President Bashar al-Assad. The U.S.-led coalition responded with devastating power. Here's Pentagon spokesperson Dana White.
Our forces have the inherent right to self-defense. We are not looking for a conflict with the regime. Any action that takes away from our ongoing operations to defeat ISIS is a distraction.
Susanna George is Baghdad bureau chief for the Associated Press and was just in Syria yesterday. Why did these U.S. advisors come under fire, Susanna?
What we're hearing from both the Syrian government and from coalition officials is this was a clash that was likely sparked over a struggle for control of oil and gas fields in this part of Syria. This is where U.S.-backed Kurdish-led forces are fighting for control of territory with Russian-backed Syrian forces and militias supported by Iran. The control of this area is pretty much split by the Euphrates River. U.S.-backed forces are on the east of the river. That's where most of the oil and gas fields are. And Syrian government-aligned forces are on the west. Coalition officials are telling us they noticed a buildup of government forces in the area. They spoke to their Russian counterparts and were assured that there would not be an attack. But the coalition said that they observed what they described as hostilities. This included the maneuvering of tanks and pieces of artillery, and that preceded the strike. Syrian State TV is calling this a new massacre, and the Russian Defense Ministry says it shows that the U.S. is not interested in fighting extremists, Islamic State group fighters in Syria, but rather is interested in controlling Syria's economic assets.
The Pentagon is suggesting that the U.S. was attacked, but who really fired first?
What the coalition is saying is that the action was launched in defense of U.S.-backed forces in the area.
So, meantime, you were in Syria yesterday on a visit with a U.S. general. What was that all about, Susanna?
This was a visit with Lieutenant General Paul Funk. He's the top U.S. general in the coalition against IS in both Iraq and Syria. And his message traveling out to this small remote outpost in Manbij in northern Syria was really a message of support for the American troops there. The outpost is very sparse. It's really just a handful of tents and a few prefab trailers, a dozen or so armored vehicles, and it's really isolated. And what Funk said is that the biggest issue for him these days is that people back home in the U.S., they think that the military campaign against IS is over. And he says that it's certainly not. There's still pockets of IS fighters in eastern Syria, and Iraq is riddled with insurgent networks connected to the group. So American commanders like Funk are saying that bases like this one in Manbij need to stay where they are to maintain stability, even though combat operations in the area are no longer ongoing. But instead, what we're seeing is that this has become a new flashpoint. The possibility of an indefinite presence of U.S. troops right up near the border with Turkey has really rattled Ankara. And Turkey has called on the U.S. to withdraw. But U.S. commanders in Manbij, they said that they have no intention of doing so.
Well, Secretary of Defense Mattis has suggested that the U.S. presence there is open-ended. I mean, how many American advisors/troops are there in Syria right now? Do we have a number?
American commanders are being really cagey with numbers. In total, I believe the latest numbers from the Pentagon are around 2,000 American soldiers in Syria altogether. And one of the American commanders who I spoke to said that there is no way of telling how long U.S. troops will need to be in Syria, just because the situation in the country that has followed these victories against the Islamic State group is in more ways even more complicated than the initial fight against the extremists.
The AP, Susanna George there. We're joined now by a guest in Damascus we've heard from before on the show, Namat. She'd like us to use only her first name. She lives and works in the Syrian capital. We caught up with her on what she calls a typical day.
I was at the gym, actually, and I finished my work. I went to the gym just like it's my everyday routine. It was very crowded. Many people were there. Life is quite normal in Damascus, except for the mortar shelling sometimes, that's especially in the last 2 weeks. Other than that, actually, it's much, much better than last year. Even when it comes to the power, the electricity, it's always there. Last year, we did not have enough electricity. Now, this year, things are much, much better. Life is improving. Even the dollar exchange rate in comparison with the Syrian pound, it's much, much better.
So, I mean, the war has been going on for almost 8 years. What do Western media still not get about it?
Actually, the Western media still insist on the idea that all of the Syrian people are against the regime, against Assad, against the Syrian army, which is not really true.
But there are a lot of people who don't support Assad, and I think the proof of that is that there's a lot of fighting going on all over the country.
Yes, let's be honest. In Damascus, for example, there are people who are against Assad. But they are against the violence as well. But they don't want also to bring down the regime. They want certain reforms. It's not a fight between the Syrians themselves. It's now a fight between regional powers and international powers. Russia and U.S., Iran and Turkey, Saudi also.
So where do your loyalties lie, Namat?
Well, I'm, of course, against the violence. I don't like to see people getting killed. I'm, of course, against having foreign intervention in my country. I don't like to see, for example, U.S. military Marines, people roaming around in my country.
Namat, have you read reports of civilian deaths, Syrian civilian deaths, that occur at the hands of your own government?
Of course, there will be a lot of reports coming out like this. But who can verify whether these are true or not? And nobody can confirm that these sources are reliable. But what about the Western media? Why they are not getting the reports about the people who are getting killed by the mortar shells, for example? In the past 2 weeks, dozens of people got killed and injured due to mortar shelling by the terrorist groups who are in Ghouta.
What about the Russian troops that are roaming your country? I mean, we do know factually about them.
Yes, but there is an agreement with the Syrian government. Currently, the Syrian government is the legitimate government. It's represented in the UN, in the UN Security Council. It's represented in the United Nations also. And according to the request of the Syrian legitimate government, the Russian troops came to Syria.
So you support the Russian presence, but you don't support the American presence?
The Syrian government, legitimate government, spoke with Russia, and the Russians sent their troops. But the Americans, they just came in with out of the blue, without any permission from the United Nations. They sneaked through the borders and got into Syria. When you go into a house without having the permission of the owner of the house, you are a thief. But when you knock at the door and we say welcome, then you are a guest.
You know, we heard from civilians in Idlib yesterday who had been watching bombs fall and continue to fall. What would be your message to them?
At the end of the day, they are just human beings and they are just victims. So when it comes to civilians, they are Syrian people just like me, just like my brother, just like my friends. It just happened that they are living in that part of the country. Maybe they were not able to flee. Maybe they were forced to stay. I have a lot of information about Syrian civilians who are stuck in Idlib and are used as human shields by al-Nusra and other terrorist groups.
Would you say you support the regime of Bashar al-Assad?
Well, I don't support the regime itself. I have a lot of reservations. I don't like everything that they are doing. There is a lot of corruption here and there. I want my country to be much better than this. We deserve more freedom. We deserve to have a proper democratic regime. But definitely this is not the way. Destroying the country, destroying the army, which was funded by our tax money.
So if I can just clarify, you're critical of the Assad government, but you support the Syrian army? Am I correct?
Of course. This is not the way how we get democracy. We don't destroy our army. bringing in terrorists from all around the world, like Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra, ISIS, etc. This is not the way towards democracy. So for me, yes, if the Syrian army is preventing those barbarian ISIS and Al-Nusra from getting into my country, then of course I will support them.
Nama, what is your greatest fear when you think about how this war is likely to end and what might happen before we get to the end?
I'm afraid that the solution might not be a Syrian solution, that if this is going to come from the outside, I don't want us to be divided. I don't want Syria to be divided into small pieces. I don't want the people in Syria to live divided according to sectarian or ethnic issues. This is my greatest fear.
Namat, it's very good to have you on the show again. Thank you for being with us.
Most welcome. Most welcome. Thank you.
Namat is a resident of Damascus. For security reasons, we used only her first name. One final note on Syria before we take a short break. It concerns a video that's been making the rounds in jihadist media. It was released by ISIS, or IS as some call them, and it features women.
Not only are they showing women, but they're showing women running around, charging in the battlefront, firing from their rifles on the battlefront in Syria. So it is a big shift in both IS's position on women as well as its position on showing women in videos.
That's my BBC colleague Mina Alami. She monitors jihadist media, and she says that until recently, IS declared the presence of women on the battlefront unacceptable. But then things changed.
So the shift happened in October 2017, and that was when IS was under intense pressure in Raqqa. It made a U-turn and said, actually, women have the same duty as men to fight in the battlefront during times of intense threat. So it did seem kind of an act of desperation because IS had already deployed disabled men, wounded men, children to the battlefront. And it seemed like the last measure is that they put out women. And I think this will have big backlash against the group by other jihadists. More traditional jihadists, if you like.
Lami says the video may be an IS recruitment tool.
It does realize that maybe for a lot of the young women who traveled to its territory, maybe it was actually a big frustration for a lot of them who found out that IS only wanted them to stay locked inside, locked at home, and bringing up what they said the next generation of fighters and serving their mujahideen husbands. If you go throughout the video, the imagery of these women with their rifles, it's kind of this very glamorous image of females on the battlefront and their role. So it's very different, and part of the tactic is to appeal to a younger generation.
She also says IS may be trying to shame more men into signing up to fight for their cause. In any event, Lami says for her, watching these kinds of videos day in and day out can take a toll.
It's never easy, and you never become used to it, which is good that you never become used to the violence in these videos. Of course, you can go through various techniques and strategies to reduce the impact, but it is difficult, and you have to be also aware of what you're about to see. But also, I think it's really good to be mindful of the purpose and the messages and what these groups are trying to do through these videos in order to, again, minimize the impact they could have on you.
That's Mina Alami from BBC Monitoring. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Tomorrow at the Winter Olympics, the athletes will be marching in the opening ceremonies in Pyeongchang, South Korea. Some events are getting an early start, figure skating for one. It's one event that always grabs attention. Often those skaters become lasting celebrities. Christy Yamaguchi, a good example. She became America's sweetheart after winning gold at the 1992 Winter Olympics. She also became the first Asian-American woman to win a gold medal in figure skating. And that's what we're going to dive in with Christy tomorrow on the show. Yamaguchi is a fourth-generation Japanese from California, and having the global spotlight fall on her made her even more aware of her heritage. Her mother, born in a Japanese internment camp in Colorado in 1945.
After receiving such support from the Asian American community and, you know, hearing why they were so proud, and that's when I started looking back at my own family history and knowing that I was just one generation away from my family who lost everything and had to rebuild their entire lives and prove their loyalty, right, to this country. That's when I realized, wow, yes, I'm able to live out the American dream because of the work and the sacrifices of, you know, the generations before me.
And now Yamaguchi is inspiring a whole other generation. Also joining Christy and me tomorrow, writer and journalist Nicole Chung. She recently wrote about how, for her, Yamaguchi was that rare Asian American sports icon at a time when there were hardly any around.
I was a Korean adoptee in a white family, so I literally did not know anyone who looked like me. Then I saw Christy on TV, like winning the gold medal, and I saw her on magazine covers, and I thought, I had dreams too, and suddenly I think all those dreams just felt like a little more real and more possible.
Sports meets identity. More of my conversation with Christy Yamaguchi and Nicole Chung on tomorrow's show. I mentioned the opening ceremony tomorrow. Athletes from North and South Korea will march together in Pyeongchang under one Korean flag. And instead of their separate national anthems, they'll be hearing a folk tune called Arirang. These days, it may be the only song that's loved on both sides of the Korean border. Next step toward unity would be a pan-Korean orchestra that could perform it. That is actually a dream for South Korean violinist Won Hyung-jun, creating such an ensemble. And if he can pull that off, Arirang is sure to be one of their standards. Jason Strother has that story from Seoul.
I'm getting a live performance of the song Arirang by violinist Won Hyung-jun. It's a traditional Korean folk song that dates back long before the peninsula's 1945 division and subsequent war. Today, in both the South and North, Arirang is considered the anthem for a reunified Korean nation.
It just touches our soul.
So for Hyung-jun, the song is an obvious selection for an inter-Korean orchestra.
Why does this song strike such an emotional chord with Koreans?
It's very sorrowful, and it feels like a pain. Yeah, it's like you have families who live in North Korea, but you can't go there, you can't meet. If you have that kind of feelings and emotions, you know, you almost like a cry, and how painful it is. You know, I have my family over there, but I can't go there. It's our tragedy. And this is what a perfect song, Arirang, you know. Yes, this is our tragedy. This is our situation to live in the Korean Peninsula.
His own family was divided.
I heard my grandfather, for example, he was longing his mother because my grandfather came to South Korea during the Korean War, and his mother couldn't be here with him. So he and his mother got separated. That's how I got raised, to hear from my grandfather that I have a grandmother, right, in North Korea.
He says his grandfather kept a pair of his own mother's shoes tucked away in a drawer to remember her, but Hyung-jun never got to meet her.
And even her tomb is in Gaesong, which is the city of North Korea.
And just across the border,
right,
from South Korea.
Right, but I can't be there. I can't even visit to meet my ancestor.
For years, Hyung-jun dreamed of bringing North and South Korean musicians together, and eventually he got permission from the Seoul government to reach out to North Korean officials. He says the North was receptive to his plan, but several attempts to perform fell through. So he got the idea to hold a peace concert in a truce village in the middle of the demilitarized zone, the DMZ.
That's the symbolic place of our division, right, of two Koreas. So let's play Beethoven's Symphony 9th at the border, across the line, by standing to each other. But we can still play together.
Through contacts in Europe, Hyung-jun set a date with a North Korean choir to meet at the border for the peace concert. The musicians would perform several meters apart from each other, separated by a fence. On that day in 2015, he and his group of musicians rode on a bus from Seoul to the border. But even though they had permission to play at the DMZ, they were stopped at the Unification Bridge.
And we were waiting almost like 2 hours, and later the military guards,
South Korean military,
yes, at the bridge, at the gate, they came into our bus and they apologized the peace concert has been canceled.
Just days earlier, a landmine explosion in the DMZ had maimed 2 South Korean soldiers, so tensions were especially high.
Do you remember what the mood was like on the bus at that time?
Yeah, I mean, that was really, it was really sad. It was really sad because I really, really believed it was going to happen. Honestly, I felt, yeah, maybe it's our destiny. It's Korean DNA that it's our fault that we can make this unification happen.
But Hyungjun didn't give up. Last August, he took around 80 musicians and singers back to the DMZ, and this time they were able to perform, though without North Korean accompaniment. And Arirang was on their set list.
And also we played near the fence. It was our wish that North Korean, they could hear our Arirang through air.
And perhaps North Koreans were listening on the other side. Hyungjun is not deterred by the setbacks. He says he hopes the combined North and South Korean entrance at the Pyeongchang Games and the unified women's hockey team can help lead to musical unification.
I heard my grandfather's longing for, you know, his mother. And I think that's one of the most important reasons that I'm not giving up even this project.
Hyungjun says he owes it to his grandfather. For The World, Jason Strother, Seoul.
I'm Marco Werman. In China, hip-hop has been pretty hip lately, but the country's top media regulator wants it off Chinese TV. This rapper in Shanghai says the ban isn't really about hip-hop itself.
It's more about not letting China be influenced too much by the West.
That story is still ahead right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Pope Francis seems eager to make a deal with China, and that is significant. The Vatican has formal relations with pretty much every country on Earth, but the People's Republic of China is a major exception. It was back in 1951 when Beijing and the Vatican cut diplomatic ties. That was soon after the communists took over mainland China. The truth is, life for Catholics in China has always been complicated. But according to several news reports, the Vatican and the Chinese government might be moving towards some kind of breakthrough. From the World's Religion Desk, here is Matthew Bell.
In China, millions of Catholics go to church every week, and about half of them are breaking the law. That's because many Catholic churches there operate in a legal gray area. They're not registered with the government. Neither are the priests and bishops that preside over them. So they're known as underground churches. And here's where the Vatican and the Chinese government have a common goal. They both want to bring these underground Catholics out of the shadows, so to speak, but for very different reasons. For the Communist Party, normalizing relations with the Vatican after decades of animosity would be a public diplomacy win.
I think Beijing, yeah, they care a bit about their image, but much more they care about control.
Ian Johnson is the author of Souls of China, a book about the country's modern religious revival.
They just issued new regulations on religion that call for even tighter control of religion. So this is not really a socially reform-minded administration that's willing to open up or take a gamble. I think if a deal presents itself, yes, that's great, they'll do it. But if not, then they're probably quite happy to walk away. And I think in any negotiation, that gives you a lot of leverage if you don't really need the deal.
Legally, China does recognize Catholicism as one of the country's five official religions. The authorities in Beijing even help appoint some Catholic bishops in China. This has long been a sticky issue with the Vatican. But in recent weeks, the Pope has shown that he's willing to be flexible. Papal authorities asked two underground Chinese bishops to resign and make way for government-approved candidates. Why? Because Francis wants to heal the divide running through the Catholic Church of China. Again, here's Ian Johnson.
Many Catholics don't feel comfortable going to the officially recognized Catholic Church because many of those bishops and the priests under them, who they appointed, were not approved by Rome. And so some people think, you know, I'm not being loyal. I'm not being a good Catholic. I'm not being loyal to the Pope if I go into these above ground churches. And so they go to the underground churches, and about half of Catholics in China go to underground churches. So it is a difficult situation, and it slows the growth of the religion.
As an example, the high estimate for Catholics in China is about 12 million people. Protestants, on the other hand, and this is the low estimate, number around 60 million. It makes perfect sense for the Vatican to try to find a way to grow the church in China by making a deal with Beijing, says Bob Fu. But he worries that Pope Francis might be forgetting this lesson from Jesus himself.
I think the church should be the church. Caesar should be, belong to the Caesar, belong to Caesar.
Fu is with a Texas-based group called China Aid. It advocates for Christian human rights inside of China. He's been following the news about this possible deal between the Vatican and Beijing, and Fu is skeptical.
I mean, Jesus Christ is the real head and only head of the church, not the Chinese Communist Party, not the Religious Affairs Bureau. So any policy that contradicts that, I think, should be invalid.
One prominent Chinese Catholic leader who shares Fu's skepticism is the former Bishop of Hong Kong, Cardinal Joseph Zen. In a recent Facebook post that went viral, Zen describes conditions for Catholics in mainland China as slavery and humiliation. And he says finding mutual ground with a totalitarian regime like the one in Beijing is just not possible. Massimo Fagioli is a Vatican historian at Villanova University. He says he understands Cardinal Zen's point of view, but Fagioli says he's got faith in Pope Francis and his diplomatic corps to find the best possible arrangement with Beijing.
The Catholic Church has the awareness of a very long history. So they don't think just in terms of anti-communism, but they think in terms of church and empire, because this is the big thing.
Fagioli says the Vatican has been making deals with earthly empires going back many centuries. Pope Francis also has his eye on the long game in China, and that's why he's willing to compromise.
Pragmatism has always been a very important factor, and as a Catholic historian, I always say, if you want to bet your money on the long run, bet on the Catholic Church on some issues, not on ideological turns of this or that day, because they think in centuries.
That's a very Chinese way of thinking, too, which makes this particular diplomatic dance all the more interesting. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
The Chinese government doesn't just have issues with the Catholic Church. Here on The World, you've heard stories about Beijing censoring everything, from messaging platforms like WhatsApp to cuddly cartoon characters like Winnie the Pooh. And now China's government has turned its attention to hip-hop. Like censorship itself, hip-hop isn't new to China, but its immense popularity is, thanks to this online reality show. It's called The Rap of China. Think X Factor or The Voice, but for, yeah, you get it. The show premiered last summer, and it was big, like 2.5 billion views big. The Rap of China launched hip-hop into the mainstream there, and several of the show's contestants went on to stardom. But it seems the Chinese government hasn't been thrilled about those developments, and last month, the country's top media regulator said national TV programs can no longer feature any hip-hop content or artists. Also, people with tattoos are now banned from making appearances, presumably because so many rappers are inked. But it's the way this ban is being discussed in some Chinese media that caught our attention. Take, for example, the Global Times, a state-backed communist newspaper. Here's part of their editorial on why hip-hop just doesn't make sense in China. Quote, every cultural phenomenon is at all times related to the social environment where it develops. Breaking away from its original surrounding can mean possible deformation or, worse, no chance to survive. So China is arguing cultural appropriation.
I think it's disingenuous. I don't really believe that the government is worried about the morality of cultural appropriation of an American cultural product.
That's reporter Amy Hawkins in Beijing.
So the Global Times, where that argument was made, is an English language state-run newspaper. And so most people reading that newspaper are foreigners, and it's a kind of insight into how China is thinking. I think the argument you find there is going to be one that's tailored to a Western audience. And so something that mentions something like cultural appropriation and the idea that, oh, maybe the government's doing the right thing and it's kind of being sensitive about this cultural issue, when really it's just trying to like tighten its grip on what Chinese people have access to.
Do a lot of Chinese artists see their relationship? Is there discussion of cultural appropriation among Chinese artists, hip hop artists?
No one I've spoken to who's a rapper or not a rapper in China has really had much thoughts about cultural appropriation. I don't think it's an idea that has as much currency. I think people see it just and it's cool, and it's like these famous rappers on TV do it, wear these clothes, make this kind of music, so we'll do it. I don't think the idea of it being offensive or inappropriate has much currency here.
This crackdown, though, isn't new either, is it? I mean, the government has been trying to rein in hip-hop and rap for a while. It just sounds like this is a formalized crackdown.
Yeah, for sure. Because it's become so popular with the mainstream, the government issued this kind of formal notice, which it's not new for the Chinese government to try and regulate what kind of culture, especially foreign culture, appears on Chinese mainstream media. It's just that recently the government has declared hip-hop and tattoos as something that shouldn't be broadcast to a mainstream audience. And I think it also taps into kind of concerns about foreign influence, and that like Chinese youth shouldn't be looking to the West for their cultural influences. They should be looking to like homegrown culture.
Reporter Amy Hawkins there, speaking with us from Beijing. She told us that even though this is bad news for rappers banking on mainstream exposure through national television, many smaller artists like the one we're about to hear from have different concerns.
The people in my circle, we never even wanted to be on national TV anyways. So it doesn't really affect us in that perspective. But, you know, in China, in order to perform in festivals, you have to submit your lyrics. You have to submit translations of your lyrics, MP3s of your lyrics, and then they have to go through approval by the government. So that will definitely be harder.
Rapper Bohan Phoenix is Chinese-American, born in China, but he grew up here in the U.S. Bohan Phoenix recently decided to move back to China to immerse himself in rap and hip-hop there. We caught up with him in Shanghai, and I began by asking him how he first got into hip-hop. He told us it was just after his family moved to the U.S. He was about 11.
I really didn't speak a word of English, and it was kind of tough transitioning. And I guess subconsciously, in that situation, I was looking for something to like identify with. And, watching American television was part of the learning process of English. And I happened to came across 8 Mile.
Yeah, 8 Mile is the story of Eminem and growing up in Detroit. What kind of struck you about that movie?
At this point, it was just purely, oh, this music made someone who wasn't accepted, accepted. So I became a huge Eminem fan. And then through Eminem, I started being, you know, open-minded to listening to other artists as well.
So these days, how would you describe your musical style and what do you write about?
I'm a family foreign, I could take you overseas. Yeah, so I definitely rap in both Chinese and English. Talk a lot about my experiences in these two cultures.
They want to know where I'm from. I see them there overseas. And over there in the plug, if you got love, put it on me.
And I haven't moved to States when I was 11, but all my family still being in China, I actually came back to China every year.
Hubei to Brooklyn to Beijing.
So I kind of wanted to come back and kind of rediscover my root in China. And the way of doing that was getting closer to my family in Chengdu, as well as making music in the motherland, in this new environment.
I mean, it's an interesting time for you specifically to go back to China and work on this project because, as you know, there's been this government crackdown on hip-hop that's been going on for years, and it's just increasing now. How much did you know about that, and how did you factor that into your decision to go back to China?
Yeah, so definitely I had that in mind. I knew there's certain things that I could say, certain things that I couldn't say. And to be honest, my thought on this whole thing, it's less about hip-hop. It's really about that. The Chinese government look at hip-hop as a part of Western culture, And it's more about not letting China be influenced too much by the West.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because there is kind of a debate over cultural appropriation in hip-hop. I know that some people have gone as far to argue that the Chinese government crackdown is actually good because it curbs appropriation of African-American culture. What do you think about that?
I had definitely seen people make comments online. It's like, you guys should not be doing this music. You know, and I totally understand where they're coming from. And because that's something what I was questioning when I got here, when I seen all the dreads and all the rappers, you know, running around doing gang gang, all that stuff. I was like, man, don't they know about the context? Don't they know about the culture? Shouldn't they be held accountable for this? And I really don't know if they should, because at the end of the day, hip hop is still music. You know, and so if they like this music and this way of expressing themselves, I think that that should be everything they need to do that.
So Bohan Phoenix, Eminem, as I recall from 8 Mile, he's ultimately respected by the other rappers, even the other crew in the final battle. What would be a respect for you and your art?
So for me, having been able to perform at Apollo Theater where Michael Jackson, James Brown, Lauryn Hill did what they, you know, did back in the days, and I'm on the same stage and I'm coming off the stage to people, you know, appreciating what I'm doing up there, that was it right there. You know, after that, it was more about finding respect for myself as an artist to continue to do this, whether people like it or not, because that's part of hip hop. Part of hip hop is doing it, whether people like it or not.
Rapper Bohan Phoenix speaking with us from Shanghai. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, guys. Thank you, guys.
A quick look ahead now at another story we're getting ready for you. It's about a campaign to ban a practice that the United Nations calls a violation of the human rights of girls and women, female genital mutilation, or FGM. But this is a story about progress. We'll hear from an activist in Somaliland, an autonomous region within Somalia. She persuaded her region's president to ban FGM.
I basically talked at him for 15 minutes and I remember him saying, like, you know, have you finished? And I said, yes. And he said, it takes a lot of guts to come and sit in front of me and talk about such an issue, but I'm glad that you have.
More of my conversation with anti-FGM activist Nimco Ali from Somaliland on an upcoming edition of the show. I have been immersed in a fascinating history of slavery in the U.S., the American Slave Coast by Ned and Constance Sublett. It's focused on the East Coast, where slavery thrived. But on the other side of the country, as far back as the 1600s, Spanish colonists were also enslaving people, Native Americans in the Southwest. It is a history that's not very well known, but these days, thanks to DNA testing and archival data, many New Mexico residents are discovering that past.
What they're finding is that they are descended from people known as jeniceros during colonial times. And these were essentially captive Native Americans who were bought and sold by Hispanic colonists in colonial New Mexico.
That's New York Times correspondent Simone Romero, who is based in Albuquerque. He says the revelations are especially jarring to Latinos who have long identified their roots as Spanish.
So this has been a startling revelation for some people. Of course, many people knew that they did have some Native American ancestry, but it's been fascinating for people to find out exactly how that came to be. And even for some people, they're finding out that they had these Native American slaves in their family tree and also slave owners. So it's been a startling thing for some people to discover.
So just give us kind of the thumbnail sketch of what was going on historically. We're talking early colonial period, going back to even the 16th century, right?
That's correct. New Mexico at that time was really at the farthest northern reaches of the Spanish Empire. Spain had sent explorers to what is now the American Southwest way back in the 16th century. And they created these outposts here and missionary forays into the region. And one of the ways that they began settling it was through colonists who came up from central Mexico, largely, also including some people from Spain. And they created these buffer communities. They started to trade with the Indians. They also, from very early on, started to enslave some of the Indians. And that generated a lot of tension in the region. There was a massive revolt here in New Mexico in 1680, an uprising. And then that slave trade evolved to include other native peoples, largely the Comanches and the Utes, who would take Plains Indians captive and sell them to Hispanic settlers. They would often label these Jeniceros as servants or as laborers. Many were purchased as children. Many were women who were purchased to work in people's homes. It's just an incredibly complex history that took place. And, you know, it endured for a very long time. There were Native American slaves in what is now New Mexico, you know, into the 1860s and 70s. Wow. So after the prohibition of slavery elsewhere in the United States, Congress actually had to pass the Peonage Act in 1867, which was targeted specifically at New Mexico to try to end this trade.
So while Spaniards were actors in enslaving Africans and taking them to the east coast of the Americas on the west side of the continent, they were doing the same with natives. And they also needed help. I mean, you write about how the Comanche and the Ute warriors got on their horses and raided the Apache and the Pawnee and others and took captives, as you say, often children. And then what would they do? Sell them at auction?
That's right. There would occasionally be these kind of trade fairs in some of the Indian pueblos in places like Taos and Pecos, where the captives would be transported and sold to settlers. And the Comanches were extremely successful in this trade. It's often forgotten now, but there was actually what is now called a Comanche Empire in parts of Texas and Oklahoma and the eastern plains of New Mexico, where the Comanches exerted a great amount of influence and sway, and they became very skilled horse-mounted warriors. So there was a lot of trade taking place, of course, not just in captives, but in other types of goods. And really, that was how this frontier society, often soaked in blood and violence, you know, really came to coalesce.
So, Simone, you write about Lenny Trujillo, a 66-year-old retired postal worker who lives in Los Angeles. What was his starting point when he set out recently to explore his ancestry?
You know, like many of us, he was interested in his own genealogy and his family tree, and he began doing historical research. His family came from a small community here in New Mexico called Abiquiu, up in northern New Mexico, which was one of those Jenicero settlements. And so he began looking into it and looking into it, and he did DNA testing as well to corroborate what he was finding in the historical record. And he was just astounded to find that one of his ancestors was one of these Jeniceros a couple of centuries ago. And not only that, but that same ancestor was owned by another person, but he was able to lift himself up out of that status and went on to actually own three other people. The way that Lenny explained it to me, he just said, like, this was, he was astounded by this discovery. And he explained this was like a level of complexity that he was not expecting, but that he was really fascinated to learn about.
So now that more and more people in the Southwest are finding out about their kind of past, this Jenicero past, what are they doing with this knowledge?
Well, it's generating a great amount of discussion about identity, and it's sort of a reflection about how ethnic identities can shift and evolve over time. Here in New Mexico, of course, you know, people with old family connections to this land have often prioritized their Iberian or Spanish heritage. You know, so there's a reckoning of sorts taking place where people are really finding out the truth behind what made their families and how they came to be. So it's very interesting. There's a group in Colorado. And of course, you know, Colorado shares many cultural characteristics and history with New Mexico, where people are really more actively identifying with their Native American heritage. They're, you know, calling themselves Jeniceros, for example. Mm. And there's also discussion here in New Mexico over whether, you know, it's correct to call Jeniceros slaves or not. You know, some people take a more nuanced approach to the issue and say that, well, listen, you know, they may have been held captive and been held in bondage for a certain amount of time, but they were also allowed to rise up out of that status and also marry into the same families that had bought them.
And you're back in New Mexico after several years in South America. New Mexico is where you were born and raised. How much of this is also a personal story for you?
Well, I was born and raised in New Mexico, of course. Then I went away and I reported from the Andes and in South America. And then I was in Brazil for 6 years. So, and I always dreamed of coming back. It's also a challenge to report on a place that I thought I knew so much about, but I'm discovering so much more now that I'm back.
Do you feel like your foreign correspondent's eye is getting retrained on your home state almost as if it is a foreign country?
It most definitely is. And it's fascinating. You know, I mean, history doesn't stand still is one thing that I'm learning right now. It's always shifting, always evolving. And these old conflicts, this old tension from the past tends to rise up in fascinating ways in the present.
Simon Romero with the New York Times joining us from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
And that's The World on this Thursday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being here. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.